Well, it is a great pleasure to have Matt Harrington for my latest Nostalgia interview, because Matt, we were at Lampeter together from...
at exactly the same time, between 1991 October and June 1994.
I'm very impressed, because I was about to say, and of course, if I say what I'm about to say, I'll have to make sure I change this immediately. Maybe things like passwords, sometimes when you have to put special dates in. One of them might be related to one of the dates that you've just given. But well remembered. So, yeah, it was Friday, October the 4th, 1991, in my case.
I suppose we should really take it up to July 1994, because that was the actual graduation day, wasn't it? I can't remember. Was it the 7th or 8th of July? Something
yeah,
like that?
One of them, because I stayed there for 10 years.
Yes.
I know that I graduated on the 12th for one of them, and the 2nd... But yeah, I think you're right. I think it was Friday the 8th of July, 94.
Yes. A funny story about that, actually, because when I left Lampeter, I didn't have a job or anything lined up. So the first thing I did was go down the local unemployment office and sign on. And I had to beg for permission to go to the graduation day, because obviously I was supposed to be looking for work.
Snap is the answer. I did the same thing. And it was kind of... because I had an interesting experience as well that I learned to drive in my, well, I was about to say in my second year, but second year into my third year and into my MA year before I finally passed my test, not on the first attempt, I hasten to add. And in Lampeter, the job centre and the place where you go for a housing benefit as well was also the driving test centre. So every time I went for a driving test, or I went to claim housing benefit or whatever it was that I was doing, I'd always encounter the same people. And it's one of those moments where you just want to avoid them, because you didn't necessarily want your driving instructor to know that you were signing on, particularly if he'd also made comments about the type of people who could be seen
He's
in that building.
Worried about where the fee for his next lesson was going to come
from. Exactly, coming from the office next door, yeah. But I was the same. And because the graduation was like on a Friday, and you had to show that you were completely available for work, And I think they said, like, you were entitled to 14 days holiday in the year. So the graduation became one of those holiday days.
Yes, yeah. I think actually in the mid-90s, from what I remember, I think the unemployment people were a bit more lenient in those days than I think they are now. I think they've very much tightened up, from what I can understand, on benefits.
I always thought in those days, because I know some people who were doing masters, and this includes me to an extent anyway, where in order to finance, unless you've got funding to do it, if you were going to do a master's degree or a PhD, sometimes you needed those benefits in order to help you. So sure, sometimes you might be doing work in the university or might be doing some part-time teaching, but you needed the benefit. But I know some people who were very conflicted about whether they admitted that they were doing a part-time degree, because they just did not know whether it helped or hindered. Because on the one hand, you had to prove that you weren't doing more than 21 hours a week, and you've then had to get your university to vouch for all of that, and some just thought it's not worth the hassle. But on the other hand, it was also nice to say, I'm not just doing nothing, inverted commas, I'm actually doing something that will lead to a career. But having done that career, it's easy to look back and say, yes, it all worked out wonderfully. I think Mick Hucknall from Simply Red, when he used to sign on, they said, what do you want to be, Mr. Hucknall? And he said, I want to be a pop star. And they were like, get a life, be real. And look what happened. So
isn't there another story from a similar era where Frankie Goes to Hollywood, they'd all signed on, and they were spotted by their unemployment officer on Top of the Pops.
Yes.
He probably stopped their benefits.
And there's another story. One of the athletes, it may be like the 1986 Commonwealth Games, who was representing his country, and because he was so many miles away or outside the radius that was deemed reasonable, he was probably like seen on TV. He'd won his gold medal or whatever, and so they docked his benefits, because he was he was actually not looking for work. He was actually representing his country. So a sanitary warning there.
I mean, you say about the financing of MAs and things. I remember I was sort of offered to apply for the MA. I think it was called the Word and Visual Imagination at some of our fellow students, and at that time, the European Social Fund actually paid you £85 a week, which was like a princely fortune, for West Wales living. Yeah, so
I was intensely jealous, because, and many of the people who will be listening to this may well think that I'm thinking of them, and they're probably right. Mm. So there were those who stayed, and some of them were actually living in the same house as me as postgraduate year. So they all got this blanket funding because they were doing this particular MA. Mm. I did an MA, and they were in death and immortality, and that was an interesting thing to explain at the benefits office. So what's your degree? Death and immortality in Western thought. And they're sort of, they're ticking their boxes and thinking, yes, well, we'll find a suitable job for you, sir. And then I remember sort of feeling that this sense of, and I suppose it, I mean, there was all jealousy was part of that, but also this sort of sense that almost the randomness that if you're doing one particular MA, you'd get blanket funding and another you couldn't. And if you were thinking of doing, making a career out of it.
The European Social Fund, and I think the reason that it received that funding was because Wales is one of the poorest parts of Europe, isn't it? Certainly.
And they had this centre, and I think because the library had all these ancient documents, which they were using as part of their resources. So I suppose it was thought that, you know, that there were precious documents here, and the university was probably under intense pressure to sell some of those in order to help its finances. So the European Social Fund, in that sense, came to the rescue by effectively showing the value of this and supporting it and the students doing that, so that effectively this could all be sanctioned. But yeah,
nice to think that some bureaucrat sitting in Brussels ticked the right box there.
Yeah, there we are, and a whole generation of people that we know,
yes,
who indeed did that program all those years ago. Yeah. As we're on that note, what was the route for you? I want to find out about the route that led you to Lampeter, but what did you do after those initial signing on periods and graduation in July 94? What did you do post Lampeter?
Oh, so initially I got a job in a local bookshop. I'm from Tunbridge Wells in Kent. So I got a job there. I did that, and I got a day off during the week. So I was still applying for jobs in London. And I'd go for my interview on the day off, sort of thing. And my cousin at the time worked for a place called Book Club Associates, now sadly defunct, but it was, I don't know if you remember, they used to advertise in all the Sunday supplements, sort of any five books for 50p, any CDs for 50p. So I'd identified it somewhere I wanted to work, but I kept hassling her. And then eventually a job came up for a junior copywriter. And she managed to sort of put my name forward. I got the copy test and I got the job. So that was quite a good in at that stage. I think I got the job just before Christmas 94. And so I remember the job was very much, you had to write about a book in 30 words, sort of for their catalogues. And you could never start a sentence, this book. So that was the challenge. And, you know, I tell you one thing about it, it makes you write with economy, because there's absolutely no flab in 30 words. You have to kind of sell it in a very short space of time. So
yeah, I always used to struggle, I think, doing philosophy in the first year, where the talent was, you know, the skill that we needed was to be able to write with precision. And I've always had the opposite problem, that, you know, if there's a 5,000 word essay, I think, you know, not deliberately can I stretch it to 6,000, because now as somebody who marks student essays, you know that when students go over, it's actually appalling, because, you know, if everyone does that, you know, it's a 5,000 word essay and you allocate time to mark it. So if everyone goes overboard, then, you know, it wreaks havoc with your time management. But I used to really struggle to condense what I wanted to say. I think I'm much better at it now, but it's like knowing what to exclude as well as what to include.
There's that famous letter, isn't there, from some worthy Victorian, somebody will check it out, but sorry I wrote you a long letter, it's because I didn't have time to write you a short one.
Yeah,
I can't remember who said that. But
well, it was probably a Lampeter graduate. I remember going to a tutor once in theology, Reverend David Selwyn area. And I said to him once, I'm writing this essay on St. Augustine or whatever it was. And I said, it's meant to be 5,000 words, but I'm, you know, if it ends up being 6,000, would that be a problem? And he looked at me and started sort of quite quizzically. And he said, do you want to be a lawyer? And I was thinking, what a strange question. And he was effectively saying, from his point of view, it really doesn't matter. And that was really sweet.
Yeah.
But that says something, encapsulates something about Lampeter as well in those days. Because these days, and rightly so, you know, students are very aware of the whole, like, the 10% rule that some people see as a rule, other people see as, you know,
was
discretionary.
That 10% over or below?
Yeah. So, and sometimes they'll be very strategic and, you know, the footnotes include. But, if you've got in-text references, then that's included. But if you use footnotes, technically, you know, there are ways of ensuring that the software doesn't count it. So that there are strategic ways if you want to go down that path. But they were wonderful days in a way, because there was that freedom in a way to explore that. Of course, you could abuse it, but effectively you had a chance to write on something you wanted to, and with the support of a tutor, that was certainly my experience, to be able to sort of find your ground, find your voice in many ways. And to find your voice, of course, sometimes in those 1,000 word essays or those 500 word pieces for philosophy, as it may have been, all those 5,000 word essays.
And I mean, I always struggled with the word counts, and I think I'm always someone that does write quite economically. I probably speak quite economically as well, so I'm not sure that's going to make me a great interviewee.
I'll make up for it, Matt.
But yeah, my little trick was to write in the margins, like in pencil, roughly, like say it was 1,000 words, I put 1037.
Yeah.
But, you know, just to get into the tutor's mind that's the number of words on those pages. And it quite often fell short by 100 or so words, so that was my little trick.
well, and you're right, because I remember with Andy White actually once having this conversation about effective like counting, like in the days when we used to write everything down rather than on a computer, where of course the computer will soon establish whether you have written 1037, but you'd sort of work out roughly how many words on a line, how many lines on a page, and multiply it. And I suppose within a certain margin, it was broadly correct, but you are right that sometimes, you know, why would anybody want to go to that sort of effort? Because by the time I'd take the line that by the time you've actually done that and counted the number of words per line, number of lines, you could probably have written the extra couple of hundred words yes. that you needed to hit the word count.
Yeah. Yeah.
but you did English, didn't you?
I did, yes. Which would make you think that, you know, you writing discursively in that kind of way would come easy, but no, I was always someone that just wrote up to the word limit, if maybe fell a bit short.
Yeah, but I remember from friends who did English, well, yourself included, but I'm just thinking of how they were always having to read probably per module, a novel a week, and certainly in a way that's a little different from my own students, who have deadlines normally perhaps at the midway point in the term and at the end of term or the beginning of the following one. I remember having an essay every week, pretty much. And I remember how many struggled with, you know, having to get through quite so many books. And, you know, to write the essay, you needed to read the book. And often it was sort of, you know, the deadline was on the Tuesday, so finish the novel on the Monday and then write the essay.
Well, my little trick there was to take all the film courses that I could, including Film and Ideology with Gordon Williams. That was a good one. Cinema, Literature and History with Peter Miles. And I also did a Make a Video course at the Media Centre, which was great fun. I really loved that. And the fact that it was counted as part of my degree was brilliant. And the other trick was to do all the poetry courses I could, because obviously it doesn't take as long to read a poem as it does a Victorian novel.
I love the way that you set yourself the challenge of doing a degree in English as somebody who perhaps wasn't as verbose or was more economical, shall we say, with the words, but then actually chose modules that were strategic. But there must have been a reason why you chose English.
I suppose it was my best subject at school, and I really enjoyed the subject. Yeah, I mean, I think I wasn't particularly like an academic all-rounder at school, certainly, and English sort of saved me in a way, because that was the thing that I was always quite good at.
I always find that, I mean, students now are making decisions based on the job market, and that's understandable, and I perhaps feel a little guilty sometimes that, you know, back in the day, I chose to do my degree not with any thought to a future career, because if anything I always wanted to do something in broadcasting, so doing theology was not an obvious route. Perhaps a bit different now, because I've kind of made that, I've brought those sort of worlds together, but that's through research over 20 odd years, rather than at the age of 18 in 1991 thinking this is going to be the obvious sort of path to the career I want to follow. And we made those decisions largely because we had a passion for the subject. And sure, there were friends known to both of us who may have gone into teaching and may even have ended up, in some cases, going to the same school that they went to. And, you know, so they followed their own dream. But I always find that there's something a little missing when you're making a decision at such a young age based on a career that you think you want to do, based on the fact that you've got this really wonderful teacher who's inspiring you, and they may well inspire you, and you may be a brilliant teacher. But do you really know at the age of 17, 18 that that's the path you want to follow?
Hmm. Well, I think, you know, things have moved on so much now, haven't they? Because I remember when I was in the sixth form and, you know, this was the 80s, I suppose, and my teacher was trying to convince me to stay at school. And he said, basically, Norwich Union at that time were offering anyone a job with two or more A-levels because there were so few school leavers with A-levels at that time. So it didn't really matter what subject you did. And again, going to university, it didn't matter what degree you did either.
You know, I think you're right. I think you're right. I think in those days, at least that was always what, I mean, particularly doing theology, it seemed to matter because there was always the sort of expectation that, you know, if you're doing the subject, are you narrowing the options available? Because the assumption would often be you're going to do something more sort of ecclesiastically based, or you're going to become a priest, or, you know, that was, you know, an erroneous sort of supposition, but one that is still often used. But at the end of the day, you just think of the skill set that you get from writing those writing 1,037 words, well, you know, economically.
And I think what I loved about Lambton, because it was a liberal arts college, and, you know, I found most of the students were kind of like-minded, yeah, you know, whether you did philosophy or religious studies or English or history, or I'd say the only kind of outliers, in a way, were the geography students, because they were a bit more... is geography kind of in between the arts and the sciences? I don't know. Yeah. It's still humanity, isn't it? But you got slightly more kind of middle-of-the-road people, but maybe that's not the right... That's not fair. More laddish, certainly, the guys' students that did it.
I think you may be onto something there, because... By the time I left in 2001, the whole geography department had gone. It was the biggest when we arrived. So there was the human geography, which perhaps was a bit more humanities based, and then there was the physical geography. But you also had archaeology, and I guess some of the archaeologists also may not have thought of themselves as overtly sort of arts based. And of course the informatics program. Someone I interviewed yesterday started it, and Jason, who will be listening to this, I'm sure, did informatics. So, and actually got made a career. I think the informatics was instrumental in his career.
Well, informatics was an outlier at Lambton because it was a useful practical skill, really, wasn't it?
Yeah. But what you said, and this is something where I have no regrets going to Lampeter, because we were all like-minded. We were all the people, and we didn't even need to talk about it. It wasn't like we were all bonding because we weren't science people. Mm. It was that implicitly we may have come from schools where there were some, and certainly in my school, amazing science-based people who went to Oxford. People went to Oxford for all sorts of subjects, but they were science people, and I was never in their league, had no interest in being in their league either. Mm. So going to Lampeter was great because it's that whole big fish, little pond situation. In school, I was kind of a small fish in a big pond. But going to Lampeter, suddenly it felt like, actually, you know, I'm not competing with the sort of people that in school always made me feel that I was wasting that's not true. And I don't think they ever would have intentionally done that. But maybe doing a subject like religious studies might, in the eyes of some, have been thought to be less useful, less practical. But we were all at a university and thriving together, having effectively surmounted those kind of obstacles. And we no longer, apart from maybe in vacation time, I guess when we went back and saw our former school friends again, is that we didn't have to justify what we did anymore because we'd all made the same decisions. So it was a level playing field.
Yes, yeah. And I think also people that chose to go to Lambton, as I did, and I went to the New Ents conference, and that... If I can quote him, I'm sure he won't mind me saying, Bob Waterhouse once said he went to the New Ents conference and he spent the two nights there. You could drink alcohol, you could dance in the disco, have a good time. It's like you're 18 sort of thing. And he just thought, I would be happy here. Mm. And that's exactly how I felt when I went to the New Ents conference. I thought, this is somewhere I could be happy for 3 years. And... I don't know. I went to other open days and other colleges and other universities, and it was... I remember going one particular place sort of in London, and it just seemed like lots of trendies from the suburbs, and I just thought, I'm not going to fit with these people.
Yeah, and I remember applying to Manchester, and somebody, maybe have been a friend at school, who'd pointed out that in a lot of subjects they'd put the tariff up, because suddenly this was the era of like Stone Roses, and it was before Oasis, but suddenly when Madchester was becoming a big thing, and of course that was the trendy place to go. So, and also for someone like me who did have this idea of doing something in the world of broadcasting, I really, you know, was happy with the decision to go westwards. So away from, I could have gone to a big city, and perhaps that would have been the obvious kind of place to go to follow that.
Because you're
of,
from Cardiff. From,
I'm from Cardiff, yes, so I went from one city, but in Wales. But, you know, a lot of my school friends stayed in Cardiff, so actually I probably had a better all-round experience than they did, because for them it was a continuation of school.
To West Wales in general, it's a lot more Welsh than Cardiff, isn't it?
And a lot of people in Cardiff wouldn't have heard of Lampeter in that sense. If I'm honest, because my sister was there before me, I'd never heard of Lampeter before the age of, well, when she went to university, when I would have been about 15. But I would have no reason to know about it, because there was no sense in which it was ever really on my radar. But I think it was a kind of strategic decision, because the course did look good, but it felt like the sort of place where you could really, and it paid off, didn't it? That it was the sort of place where you'd make good friends, because the place seemed intimate. I mean, it can go one of two ways, I guess. But it was, my worry at that age was that a city university, I was not ready for that kind of life. I think at the age of 50,
Exactly the same. I probably could have gone to London, because London was reasonably familiar, because I don't live too far from London. But so, like going to somewhere like Manchester, no way, I couldn't have done it. I probably could have done, but it would have been quite daunting.
I don't know if you found this about Lampeter as well, that there are lots of big characters, and I always wondered, those people, larger than life characters, who we still think of very fondly, and who appear, sadly, in one case, on the obituary pages of the Link, but people who made a mark, who really came into their own, who were accepted at Lampeter, and you wonder what would have happened if they'd gone anywhere else, because would they have just been dwarfed in a big city environment? If they'd gone to Manchester or London, what sort of experience would they have had? Because they really made their mark in a place that was outside the norm in that sense.
It was, wasn't it? Yeah. So, it was extremely tolerant when you think of it. And I think you were alluding to Alexis, weren't you? Yeah, I remember she went off with the rugby team in the minibus sort of thing. And, you know, I just love that, the fact that there was that tolerance there between the sort of rugby player types and Alexis. Yeah, I think also Lampeter really attracted people who were, I don't know whether it made them eccentric or whether they were eccentric before they applied, but
I've really reflected on that. I think we were at the same event, and it was the 2019 London branch dinner.
Yeah,
when somebody had a go, shall we say, diplomatically at the speaker for the evening, and people were joining in, and there was this, and there was somebody was complaining about whether the person was sufficiently Lampeter enough, or whether that they, you know, that they had an investment in the Lampeter campus rather than the London branch, etc. And what I remember is that there were some people with some very pointed arguments, and yes, alcohol had been drunk, and that no doubt contributed to it. But I suddenly, and even though some of them were like 70s graduates, so I didn't actually know them, because we had our own table. Everyone on our table was from you know, pretty much 91 to 94. So, but I was sitting in there, and I thought, when was the last time I was in a room like this? And it really was Lampeter, that there was a particular, like, people were being very particular about something in a way that was like, does it really matter? Yeah. But it mattered, because if you invest in, put all your energy and indeed make a decision to go somewhere for 3 years of your life with all the, you know, everything that follows in terms of reunions and just the sense that you're indebted to a place really that has moulded you, then you're going to be precious about that place. And that's what I was hearing, is that people were, they cared so much about it. But I was thinking, gosh, you graduated 50 years ago, but it's almost as though it's life and death. And I was thinking that actually I belong here as well, because although I did feel that I didn't like the antagonism element, I could also see that I was in a room with like-minded people.
Yeah, I remember that evening, because that's the first reunion I went to, 2019, just before the COVID thing unfortunately happened. And it was something very quirky about it. I don't know whether the venue was great, the National Liberal Club, but I remember even the waitresses bringing over the food. It was almost like Mrs. Overall kind of thing, wasn't it?
Spilling the soup, yeah.
And the mixture of characters, it was just brilliant. And the guest speaker, it was all very slightly off-beam, or I don't know, it was slightly left-field or something.
And I think that we were in the heart of London. I mean, we were literally just by Charing Cross Station, Trafalgar Square, the Thames was running literally, you know, adjacent to the building. And yet we were transported somewhere where I think emotionally most of the people in that room was, which was in West Wales. And many of those people haven't been back, and or hadn't at that point been back, at least for several decades. But what you realise is, you know, the old adage about, you know, you can take the student out of Lampeter, but you can't take Lampeter out of the student. That evening, it was the first time I'd had a proper, I'd been to one Lampeter reunion the previous year. So this was one of the very first kind of proper Lampeter initiations, should we say, or of being with lots of people from Lampeter. Mm. And you realise that it's very different from the sort of space that I'm used to with colleagues from work, also in an academic environment. But but I suppose it takes a certain sort of mindset, not just to go to Lampeter, but to stay there and then be committed to it afterwards. And everyone, that was what we all had in common that night.
Yes, and I think when you think back to the sort of students when we were students, it was sometimes quite obvious the people that had put it down as first choice, and it was obvious people that had got there through clearing, you know, people that probably would have been happier in a Manchester or somewhere like that. But they grew to love the place, and it got under their skin as much as it did my skin or your skin. I'm guessing you put it as first choice.
Oh, absolutely, I did. Yeah.
I knew that, yeah. although I didn't know that. So,
oh yeah,
I was confident enough to say that.
I was at that same. I'm sure we even met at that new entrance conference.
Yeah. That's what's great about the place. I've never had any regrets about going there. I always say to my kids, you know, I was born in London, but I was made in Lampeter.
Yeah,
obviously, wherever you go, it forms you because it's that important stage of life, being a young adult away from home the first time, etc. But there's something particularly special about going to Lampeter.
And I always found as well, I mean, that new entrance conference, so it was in January 91, around the time of the Gulf War, because I remember that. So rather than go down the bar, I remember walking through the bar thinking, you know, I suppose I was thinking, I'm technically 17, therefore I can't drink, you know, as if anybody was saying, you know, passports, please, you know, where's your driver's license? No, we're not going to let you drink. And I remember going to the what in later years became known as Ron's Bar, and we were sitting watching the TV. And actually Donna Mills, as she was in those days, who I interviewed a few years ago for this, remembered me sort of sitting there. We were watching the TV together, but that was our own thing. And that was nice that we, you know, obviously in later years, I was down the bar pretty much every night, but in a way I found early on my métier. But this is the thing that I remember most from that new entrance conference, and I'd be fascinated if you were there as well, but they put a film on I think it was the second night. It was Taxi Driver. I don't know if you went to that, if you remember.
I think I went to the March 91 UH conference, so they must have had two. Yeah,
that makes sense, actually. But I went to the one in the January, and they put Taxi Driver on. Now, I'd never heard of the film, and I ended up, and I know it was because of that evening, ended up doing a doctorate some years later, which looked not just at that film, but that was one of the main, you know, areas of focus. Because it was a film that confused me, challenged me. I was intoxicated, mesmerised by it. I was 17. And it was a film that was, you know, quite a brave thing to put on. I know they showed Clockwork
quite
Orange,
intense, isn't it?
And they showed a Clockwork Orange, didn't they? In our first year, you would have been at that. And again, that was and The Exorcist was shown as well. So what I remember is a lot of, you know, Lampeter in a way that there was a sort of a transgressive element. There was a sense that they could get away with things there. That we talk about Manchester. If they tried to show some of those on a campus in Manchester, I'm guessing maybe they would have been raided. You know, they would have got into trouble. I could imagine that it would have been harder to get away with it.
It's like different rules applied because it was in West Wales, which is a bit of geographically a bit peripheral. Is that what you mean?
That's what I mean, I think it was more the feeling that because it was a bit sort of far out, a bit, there were things in that sense that were just a little bit easier to do. Because I would imagine that in a place like Manchester, you know, it would be harder perhaps to show things because you'd be rattling too many, you know, licenses would be revoked or yes, people would complain and, you know, the police would come on board. But somehow they left us alone.
It's a tightly regulated kind of environment, I think we should stop having a pop at Manchester. Yeah. Seems to mention it quite a lot.
Although in mentioning Manchester a lot, although that was one of the places I put down on the list, it's funny because now, much as I love my time in Lampeter, I think that it doesn't have to be an either or. I think that it's quite possible to sort of spend your time, and that was the mistake I made. It's possible to spend your time in Lampeter and then you're set up for whatever life throws at you. My mistake perhaps was to think, oh, I had a wonderful 3 years as an undergraduate. I must continue on that journey and get another degree there. When I got that, get another degree there. And I don't regret on so many levels what I did, but it was interesting that I thought that because I'd had this amazing time in this very unique environment, that therefore, if I wanted to prosper and grow, I needed to do so within the same geographical environment, rather than imagining I could apply those skills somewhere else. And and that's why, we are mentioning Manchester a lot. But I find that as a counterpoint interesting, because for me in those days, it really was Lampeter. I couldn't have seen how I could transition anywhere else. Transitioned into Lampeter, and therefore I wanted to stay on that particular journey.
Yeah, I think Lampeter was a very safe place really to grow up, wasn't it, and develop as a person. And I mean, I didn't get into the union or anything like that, but a lot of people did, and the skills they must have developed in miniature on this kind of miniature scale, being a VP, whatever, in the union.
And you see it now, because some of those people are, some of them, indeed, one who was the president in our first year is a Tory MP for Lincoln. It was Carl McCartney.
Yes, I see him all the time on the Transport Committee videos that I have to watch through my job.
And again, so in a way, I mean, whether, I'd like to interview him, it'd be interesting to know whether... Yeah. That was his plan, that not necessarily to be on a transport committee, but to be someone who, in doing what he did at Lampeter, was kind of setting himself up for a world where
for a larger stage
for being president of a union. I mean, obviously many Tory MPs have been president of Oxford or Cambridge, but nevertheless that was an important sort of
One person I'm always intrigued by, and I barely met him really, was the principal in our first term, Lord Morris of Castlemorris, because he kind of, from what I know of him, Lampeter must have been a very small stage for him, and he was very eager, wasn't he, to sort of, showcase his talents on a national stage. I think that's what paved the way for his peerage and everything else, with the Labour Party at that time.
Yeah, because at the time he was, as I understand it, a whip in the House of Lords. So he was already Lord Morris of Castlemorris, and so really I think it was D.P. Davis, Professor D.P. Davis, who was the vice principal and then deputy vice chancellor, or vice, whatever the title was. He effectively ran the place, I think, on a more day-to-day basis. But I guess having that national stage was a good thing, because it meant that Lampeter was in the, effectively well covered by someone in influence.
One of my first experience of Lampeter really was sort of the sixth form library. We have all the prospectuses for the universities, and guy I was with at the time said, "Oh, my friend from school, who I also coincidentally went to primary school with, went to Lampeter. He really loves it." And I picked up the brochure, and it was you'll remember it. All those amazing arty shots of old building, and very glossy, very kind of Oxbridge-y looking. And it wasn't until we went to that 2019 reunion that I realised that it was Lord Morris of Castlemorris that pulled some favours with some friends at the Arts Council who'd got this, amazing photographer to go there and take all these amazing shots and produce these very glossy prospectus.
Yeah, because he was, in that sense, a more sort of absentee principal, because he would come at the beginning of term, he'd give his speech at the beginning to new students, and he'd officiate at graduation, but effectively day to day it was unusual for him to be there. I think the role of vice chancellor changed.
Do you remember his first speech to the freshers? He was very charismatic, wasn't he?
And I'll take this out if I'm saying anything that he didn't say, but he was quite sort of open about students sort of sleeping arrangements kind of thing. It was effectively acknowledging that you're adults, and as long as you do things in a way that is appropriate, he may not have, I'm not saying he said consensual, or I don't want to put words in his mouth that maybe would have to be said these days, but it was certainly an acknowledgement that you're adults and you will do adult things. Let's be honest about that. And he was in saying the sort of things that, as we'd all left you know, recently left school, the sort of things that, you know, you wouldn't necessarily expect someone in authority to be telling you, because at school, you know, certainly in my school, no one ever talked about sex. So suddenly it was like, you know, almost like, are we in some great sort of permissive yes. kind of like environment?
Yeah. But, it's all very sudden, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, but it was yeah. like, what? You know, yeah. suddenly, you know,
it's a cliff age,
I've
really,
just said goodbye to my parents, and yeah. now suddenly yeah. I'm, you know, we're entering this brave new world. But that was quite memorable.
Just on yeah. that, I just remember, was it Barry Burnham? What was his role?
Oh, yeah, he was in archaeology. And at one point, I think he was the dean.
The dean, that's it. Yeah, he had to follow Lord Morris. And obviously, Lord Morris had done this very funny, entertaining speech. And he had to do the more dreary sort of day-to-day stuff. And he said, my role is not here to make jokes. Yeah. I just felt sorry for yeah. him. He was like the deputy yeah. head who had yeah. to enforce discipline sort of thing, you know.
Yeah. yeah. Well, yeah, it's like the, you know, John Major had Michael Heseltine as his deputy prime minister, and you were always kind of aware that there was, you could imagine the roles being flipped in,
yes.
in another kind
yes.
of context.
Yeah. I think when I you're the you top mean. Guy mm-hmm. or top woman, you have that freedom to sort of float above things a little yeah. bit, don't you? The day-to-day operational side of things.
Yeah, and also he struck me in that sense as quite a very sort of charismatic figure. But but it's interesting for me just a few months ago to interview one of his predecessors when, well, not him, obviously the actual predecessor, he passed away in 1984, but the meeting the sisters of Lloyd Thomas.
Mm-hmm.
John Rowland Lloyd Thomas, who was principal from the mid-50s till the mid-70s, and then to see how Lampeter in those days, you know, was a very traditional sort of institution where the students would be wearing gowns, academic gowns, on a daily basis. You had to be in your rooms by a certain point in the evening. And so that was, you know, late 60s, early 70s, when that was sort of the norm, certainly before Lampeter became part of the Federal University, which was probably before we were even born, like, around 71.
Isn't it crazy to think that? Because when we went back to the bicentenary reunion in 2022, and I saw all those pictures up because they had the exhibition of the history of the college and stuff, and the fact that they didn't admit women till the late
yeah, 60s. I think the first entrance was 65 or thereabouts. So
yeah,
they would have graduated
so
in 68.
26 yeah. years before we
before
entered.
We started.
Yeah,
not many years before
crazy.
We were born. Yeah. And also at one of the reunions, it was the first one I went to in 2018, three of the women from that cohort returned. So they were probably around 70-ish, I suppose, at the time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so they were one of barely even a dozen, I think, in a student population that was, you know, 90% male. But again, unthinkable, especially I teach in a religious studies department where 2/3 of the students are probably female. So to imagine Lampeter as a male-only preserve in that sense,
yes,
you know, is not what we experienced.
It was so interesting. Listen, I can't remember the guy's name, unfortunately, but he was the oldest graduate that spoke at the bicentenary thing. And he was talking about sneaking out to meet girls through the, I don't know, wasn't there bars in the window or something?
Yeah.
In the
yeah.
Just a completely different world to the one we experienced.
It was. And one of those things that we were all gathered for the same reason, that, you know, Lampeter was precious to all of us. And yet you realised that, and I know who you mean, and I think he went there in 49. So he was actually, although he was a 50s graduate, he actually was a 1940s entrant. And yeah, and the world he was outlining, when, but you know, about the mass in Latin and you know, sort of, you know, all the different sort of rituals that were day to day, it did feel far removed. And I wonder what, you know, my own children would think of the sort of Lampeter experience that we had, because at the time we probably thought we were amazingly modern and high tech, and, you know, but we were standing up to use the phones at 6 o'clock in the evening on the outside Station Terrace, because, you know, it was cheaper after six. We'd all be standing in a line to sort of speak to our families and so on. So, you know, we didn't have mobile phones in those days. We lived in a town without a railway line. So I suppose from the point of view of a subsequent generation, it's interesting that we made a home there.
Yes, well, you had to make your own entertainment because there was no option, was there? And there was nothing to do on a Sunday. I do remember this. I used to go with my best friend still, Andy Rackham, to the King's Head for Sunday lunch, and there was nothing to do between Sunday lunch and the film in the evening at the art tour.
That's right.
That stretch of time just seemed interminable. A Welsh Sunday, you know.
Yeah.
There was nothing open, nothing to do.
No, you are right. I think there were places, because it was all to do with like floor space, that the spa, I think, you couldn't serve alcohol, but the spa could open. But the bigger sort of, not the Lambert had many bigger town places, but they could open for a limited period. But the alcohol could only be served between like 12 and 3 and 7 and... 10:30, because 10:30 was when on a Sunday you had early, you know, slightly early closing. But I remember one evening somebody had said, "Oh yeah, maybe take some drinks through to the arts hall." So because the film started at 7, at like 7:15, I remember going into spa thinking, "Oh, well, you know, I'll buy this for later," quite naively. And the woman, you know, it's humiliating because you know, you should, you know, have you not lived here for this long? And she said, "I can't serve you." And she pointed to the sign. I'm humiliated, and I think I squeaked something along the lines of "it's for later," and it's like, "Oh, therefore have what you like." No, sadly. And I was thinking, but the film starts at 7, so it's like, but I can't come back later because it's a long film. It's a double bill tonight, no alcohol for me. But yeah, but that was, you know, that was 90s Lampeter. And I think that's a really good point that you make, because again, the thought of, you know, and of course in those days, you know, like pubs, you know, didn't really accommodate children and so on. So there was that sense that it felt really, in a place like Lampeter, sure, Sunday afternoons might be a good time to get some work done, some writing done, because, you know, you had the film to look forward to.
Even the library
7.
Was on short hours, wasn't it, on Sunday?
I don't think, if it did open on a Sunday. Yeah. Possibly that did open in the afternoon, that's a good point.
Yeah, the Refect did, I remember. The Refect shut on a Saturday, I seem to remember.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think Sunday it opened for Sunday lunch, but Saturday was the day that a lot of people exited. If you were going to get away, Saturday was your day to do that. But your motives for, so we've covered why you went to Lampeter in the first place and what you learned from it there. I mean, what about growing up? So you mentioned Tunbridge Wells and also London. So were you born in Tunbridge Wells?
I was born in London, like an outer suburb of London. Mm. I moved when I was 3 to Kent, so I have been in Kent, sort of East Sussex, ever since, really.
Because what I remember most from Lampeter is that like 50% of the people I spoke to were all from London and the South East. The guy who lived next door to me in Burgess Hall, who had a very similar name, Chris Davey, I think he was from Southend-on-Sea, and our mail used to get mixed up sometimes. Yeah. And he was from Southend, and that just seemed quite sort of normal. A lot of students from Hastings.
I think about 50%, if I'm right in remembering this, and I'm quoting from a good university guide at the time, about 50% of the students at Lampeter were from the home counties. And I think the reason for that is because if you're from the home counties, well, first of all, you don't have a very... strong sense of regional identity, obviously, because everything's very homogenous, and you know, and also you see Wales as somewhere you might go on holiday, and it's this kind of wonderful sense of escapism. Oh, I'm going to university in Wales, you know, somewhere I went on a family holiday once or twice, so
yeah,
a different country. A long way from home. I think there's something quite freeing about that, certainly for me anyway.
Also, because we had grants in those days, that there were some people who were like, OK, well, I can go as far away in Scotland or Wales as I want. And these days, a lot of... So we're talking now in Canterbury and Kent, where a lot of my students live, you know, not just, you know, you mentioned 50% of students in Lampeter were from the home counties, but, you know, a significant number of students are from London and the South East here. So for it's the opposite, really, that they will stay close to home rather than go as far away from home. So the dynamics have shifted hugely in 30-odd years. But so many of the students in our day, I guess, sort of saw this as the chance to live some kind of independent, autonomous life. And that Lampeter was kind of where, if you weren't accepted, or if there was something that maybe held you back, or by your peers in school or family... at home, then, you know, Lampeter, not least because of its distance, just allowed that other part of the persona to come out.
Absolutely, because you can reinvent yourself, can't you? You can reinvent yourself at the age of 18 or 19. You know, so no one knows your past. No one knows what you were like at school. It's really liberating, that, isn't it? You know, you could be the cool guy. You could buy a leather jacket, and suddenly you go into the student bar. You're a cool guy. No one knows that you weren't for the last 18 years.
No, this is the thing, but this is the conundrum I'm trying to work out in my case, because in a way, I didn't have that sort of rebel moment. You know, so I went to a place like Lampeter, which was full of some wonderful, eccentric people. Myself, I'm not disputing that I would be included in that. But the leather jacket, in my case, has only been in the last few years. So it's almost as though I was aware of the sort of, let's call it the rebellion, that a place like Lampeter sort of facilitated.
Yeah.
But it still took me many, many years, and even after leaving Lampeter, to kind of follow through on that. But it's still part of a Lampeter journey. So it's like a delayed one. It's like, you know, it's the sort of sense that, you know, Lampeter allowed me to be myself, but that didn't mean to say that I suddenly had to, overnight, suddenly become this different person to the person I went to school, you know, the friends who went to school with me or my family. I didn't change. I don't think I'm that sort of person who, you know, is a different person in different environments. But I think that it just gave me the chance to see things through a different sort of lens. But also to remember, this is the bit crucially for me, all those years after leaving Lampeter, the impact of the people was such that during periods of my life when I might have thought, oh, you know, this is not going, you know, these are not my happiest days. I had some wonderful days as a university student, and here I am now, something's gone wrong, something's out of alignment. But I was using as a marker those Lampeter people, those Lampeter experiences, as a sort of, this is the optimum Chris. This is Chris when, you know, when he can rebel, but actually he goes down the bar every night and he goes to every film club, but he never misses a lecture and always gives his essays in on time. Mm. So it was so what I did was I had the chance to live, and I did. I don't look back and think, oh, I should have gone out a bit more, I should have lived a bit. You know, I know a few people who said, yeah, they never went out, that, you know, they didn't know many people, they'd stay in and work on their essays, but didn't really have much of a social life. I did. I fully embraced every facet of that. But I think that has enabled me to do a lot of the things that I'm doing now, because I may have physically eventually left Lampeter, but there was something of those Lampeter experiences that I think is still ingrained in me. And that's why I gravitate so naturally, not least, you know, through the interviews, where so many of my interviews have been from Lampeter, yourself included, so naturally over the years. It's something that you've picked up on, because you've obviously had peers and work colleagues from who've nothing to do with Lampeter when you are in Tunbridge Wells. But you also have a very core Lampeter community in and around Tunbridge Wells. So are you aware that these, you know, is there a fluidity between these worlds, or does Lampeter represent something a little bit different?
I mean, when I left Lampeter, I moved to London fairly quickly afterwards, within about 8 months, I think. And very quickly, a Lampeter community built up in Lampeter, mainly around Balham and Clapham, places like that. And it was almost like we transported Lampeter to London.
Yeah.
And
even comedy.
I found London people quite harsh at that time. It was all very, perhaps it was the field I worked in, it was very competitive, talk about books, films, that kind of thing. Whereas I used to love meeting up with my Lampeter friends socially around that time, because it just, I'm with my people again. It all seems a bit more relaxed, a bit more leisurely, a bit less judgmental, perhaps. So you say you were at Lampeter for 10 years. I almost feel I was at Lampeter for 6 years, because the 3 years I was at Lampeter, and then 3 years afterwards in London, because there were so many Lampeter alumni that moved there.
But also,
mainly for jobs, of course.
But. Yeah, but the thing that you're testifying to is that even outside of Lampeter, the values, the experiences, the people, the integrity of the experience could apply elsewhere. I'm not sure it did in all cases. I think for some people, when they were in Lampeter, they were in the zone. Outside of Lampeter, kind of, they had other worlds to inhabit. But what I learned over the years is that even after many decades of being in touch with precious few people from those Lampeter days, I could never escape it and didn't want to. I kind of knew that I had to go back in order to move forward. You know, even now, instinctively, you know, I don't sort of consciously think, oh, well, I'll have to do another Lampeter interview and talk about Lampeter for an hour. But it comes to me very naturally. And I think that I kind of found my, at a very young age, I found my home, a spiritual home. But also, I think my mistake might have been that I didn't know when to leave. Is that maybe it's like a good lesson has to end. I'm sure my students would say the same. Even a bad lesson has to end at some point, and you need to say, well, we've learnt these skills, thank you very much, and now we're going to go on, you know, to do the next thing.
Yeah.
Whereas my mistake was, ooh, right, this lesson might be coming to an end, so let me start another lesson in the room next door kind of thing, or even in the same room when it becomes vacant. And I think that was perhaps where the thing I mistook, in a way, Lampeter for the Lampeter experience, if that makes sense. So I imagined somehow that I had to stay there and stay put to have a wonderful time, even though I was fully aware that all those wonderful people like yourself who had left at that point were no longer physically there.
Yeah.
And I think I just didn't quite make that transition. I somehow imagined that I had to I had to be the anchor. I had to stay put in there in a way to almost like continue that kind of tradition.
I visited probably about 3 or 4 times the year after we graduated. And obviously it's not quite the same. You get the language students coming back, you get the philosophy students who do 4 years, you get the MA students. The people in the years below you, but it's not quite the same, is it? And then I went back 2 years after we graduated. I went to see a friend who lived in Wales. We thought, oh, should we just go up to Lampeter? You know, just went there for the night, stayed in the Black Lion, I think. And just we knew enough people there, but it was already changing. Of course, universities always do, don't they? You get 1 year intake and then 1 year leave and. It's only yours for as long as you're there, I suppose, isn't it?
There is, but I think there's somebody who did English, Peter Mitchell, who is still there, or certainly was there quite recently. So he was the one who outlasted everybody in that respect.
Wow.
So it just goes to show that, you know, so obviously I thought I was there as a veteran in a way, but there were plenty of people who eclipsed me. And you mentioned Peter Miles. I met him this summer just gone when I was at the reunion in July.
Is he still teaching?
No, he's retired now, but he went there around the year I was born. So, he's as old as...
Yeah.
So his time in Lampeter is, you know, equivalent to, you know, our age, you know, on the planet. So in that sense, and so many people I met made Lampeter their home. Not necessarily Welsh people, far Peter's journey is not dissimilar in that sense that he came from sort of the home counties, but made his way to Lampeter, but made his home there. And I think that's, you know, a testament to the place.
Yeah, I mean, my Lampeter group of friends were very, very tight for a long time, I'd say a good 10 years after we graduated. And then inevitably people get married, they have families of their own. And I think that's a natural thing to sort of split off into those family units, isn't it? But it's still there. It's always there in the background. You know, if I need to call on those friendships or those people, I know they're still there, kind of, they're still around. I still see them quite frequently enough. But,
yeah. Are there things that remind you of those sort of days? For me, I recorded lots of stuff off the radio, legally or otherwise, and I still listen, you know, I digitised all these tapes back in sort of 2011, 2012, and I listen on a constant loop. There's like 90 hours worth of stuff, just stuff I'd be sitting in my room, ostensibly writing an essay, and I'd think, oh, I like that song, and I'd play a bit of some of the DJs' voices. A lot of those DJs have now passed. So it's a moment in time, and I can, in some cases, work out the time that was done on the basis of memory, diary entries, you know, what I was recording, and a whole range of things. So I'm constantly reliving Lampeter every time I'm in my car. But does that work for you as well? Is there a lot of people have mixtapes or particular music or gigs that you went to?
I wasn't mad keen on the sort of music that was around in the early 90s. It was a lot of dance music and things, wasn't it? And I do remember I had a Renault 5 in my first year. And the only thing... I didn't have a tape recorder in it even, let alone a CD player. And the only radio station you could get in West Wales was Atlantic 252. Do you remember that?
I do remember.
And they used to... I think they used to give people £1,000 on the hour or something. It was this... It was very commercial. And it had a very limited playlist. But one of the songs I did like was... What Can You Do For Me? Utah Saints. That takes me back to Lampeter. Yeah. That takes me back to 91, 92. And another song that does is... Which was always being played on the jukebox in the bar... Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Oh, Nirvana.
Yeah, Nirvana. That's another one. So I think they're the two songs that I always link with Lampeter.
Now, interesting that... So we would have probably been at the union the same nights, and I wouldn't probably even recognise those songs. But I would hear a lot of the older, the quirky stuff. Like, you'd hear Nirvana on the jukebox, But you'd also hear things like Minnie Riperton or Elton John or ABBA in a time when ABBA wasn't quite so cool.
Yes.
I remember one abiding memory I have. I think I walked through the bar one evening. I used to go on my own a lot. And catch up with friends down there, or maybe just randomly, you know, just hope that I'd bump into someone. I remember one evening, probably around Christmas 92, and I walked through and was always very self-conscious, you know, going in. And, you know, if you didn't see somebody you knew, you just sort of slink off again and then think, okay, how am I going to, you know, what's my strategy here? Because I really want to drink, but, you know, I'm not quite confident to go in and stay in. So I'd maybe give it 5 minutes, then repeat the experience, you know, embarrassing. Oh, please God, I'm seeing somebody
I knew.
You
always go to the games room.
Yeah,
you?
Yes, that's then right. Oh, I did, yeah, many a time. Yeah. But I went in this one evening, and it was You Are My Destiny by Lionel Richie. Again, not the most sort of typical, because the music you've just mentioned, Utah Saints or Nirvana, but that came on, and that's, you know, that's more my kind of thing, I guess. And so that came in, and it was You Come In or whatever, and it just fitted. Almost that song was, you know, allow me to breeze through the bar, because it suddenly made unusual, because I used to I'd walk with a hunch sometimes, and I was just a little bit sort of socially awkward. But that came in, and I suddenly thought, actually,
it's lifting me up.
Lionel, allowed, this is Lionel. I thought, this is my kind of thing. Like, there was one Arts Hall disco where it was all, you know, it was meant to be Christmas 90, no, I think it was 92. And I, you know, it was a Christmas disco, but there was nothing Christmassy about it until Don't You Want Me by the Human League, which was a Christmas number one, came on. And suddenly, you know, I cannot dance. I've got two very gifted daughters who do ballet. They don't get, apart from maybe the fact I've got long limbs, they get none of their dancing prowess from me. But suddenly I owned the floor for those 3 or 4 minutes, because, you know, not that I could dance, I couldn't, but it didn't matter, because this was my space. In a way, I could not do anything but be up on that dance floor, because this is my childhood. This is, you know, I grew up with this, and I couldn't just sit on the sidelines. And those are the things that I remember of being a sort of feeling a bit marginal, feeling very detached, feeling a bit awkward, but knowing I want to be part of something. But then if, on occasions, feeling that I had my moment.
Yes.
That's kind of what I remember.
No, I liked the fact that, you know, they played the golden oldies, like you say, somehow, Elton John in the bar and the disco, didn't they?
Yeah.
I had one friend in the second year. He was a returning language student, so he was in his fourth year doing German. Jim Morrison, might as well give him a name check. And he was very discriminating about what music he would dance to. And the only I just remember him sitting out every single song apart from Rage Against the Machine, Killing in the Name of. Then he'd get up and do this angry, stroppy sort of dance. Then he'd sit back down again.
And there was me waiting for Magic Moments. And once that happened, actually, they played Perry Como Magic Moments, and everyone like still thinking, is this a joke? Yeah. And they got up and they just thought, well, let's just do it. Then it stopped. They all went back down again. And then the normal music resumed. And I was thinking, no, you missed the trick. You know, come on. You know, this will never happen again. Yeah. It's you know, the stars have aligned.
Do you remember the jukebox in the games room upstairs?
Oh, yes.
They never changed the singles, as far as I knew, for the 3 years.
That's the first time I met you, I think, by the way.
Was it?
One, like, Saturday morning, very early on.
Yeah.
I'd completely forgotten about it. Mm. I do remember that. And it was the swivel thing that, you know, you played the actual records.
Because the only song I'd ever put on was Message in a Bottle by The Police. That's the only single I actually liked in that jukebox. And they never changed it.
But you played it.
It was frozen in time.
Although, thinking about it, how much money did you put in to play Message in a Bottle, you know?
20p, maybe?
Yeah, but over the years. Yeah,
I mean, oh, I see.
You could have bought it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You could have had your own copy.
When you play a record on a jukebox, it's more that you're changing the mood of the room, isn't it? A bit like being a DJ.
Yeah. I used to find as well in those days, in that room, there was a TV, because we had the 92 general election during our first year. And I had a small black and white TV, but because we didn't have, you know, social media and so on, you know, really the news, the 9 o'clock news, whatever, was kind of a big event, because, you know, if you wanted to know what was going on in the world, kind of, we didn't have CFAX really, no, unless you had a TV. I don't even think Lampeter carried, you know, the signal that would allow you to watch something on CFAX. So going to the games room and watching the news. Sort of incongruous looking back, because you'd have thought of going to a pub in order to watch Michael Burke reading the news or whatever, but that's kind of what I remember as well. And I could have watched it in my room, but I kind of liked the fact that there was an environment.
Yeah,
because you know, that it was the big election, because I only ever remembered a Labour government. I was born, well, I suppose Ted Heath was Prime Minister when I was born. But it was just that kind of thing that it felt like something, because in the end we had 5 more years of John Major, but it did feel at the time that something silent was happening, and it was the first chance for us to vote. And for me, that was like one of the biggest things. I mean, you know, I think there was a lot of apathy among students. I don't think everybody was perhaps that bothered. But it did feel that we could make a difference, that we were the generation that
could enact a shift. It's funny you say that. I remember at the time I did actually join the Labour Club. It must have been in the first year. Because when was the election in 92? Was it May?
April the 9th. Oh,
wow, that's good recall. Yeah. That's amazing.
But I do live in the zone, you know, on a pretty much daily basis. Yeah.
Anyway, I joined the Labour Club with a friend, who, funny to think now, he was a member of the Labour Club because he's become quite conservative in his middle age. So I won't help him.
And for the ladies and gentlemen at home, I'm waiting for Matt to mouth the words at me, but he's being very diplomatic. But that's the other thing, because I'm not sure that I've been all that, you know. I like to think that I'm a consistent figure, but I might be more confident now in ways that I wasn't then. But politically, I may have voted for a few different, well, two different parties my whole life, but that's more because, not that I changed my thinking, but I didn't necessarily think that the party that I'd once voted for were necessarily in line with, subsequent leaders, or, you know, I didn't necessarily like what they stood for. So it's interesting when those sort of shifts happen, and how you feel when you then meet those people again and discover that actually they've almost like switched to another side. Mm. And you're thinking, hang on a minute, but the thing that we had in common was that we agreed on all these things. So are we now going to be sworn enemies?
I think it's normal, isn't it? Everyone's on a journey.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was having this conversation with someone the other day. I think it was with some young people at a conference, and we're saying how you do. It's quite normal to go from shift rightwards as you age. Because when you're young, you don't really have a stake in anything, so it's normal and natural to want everything to be paid for, really, isn't it? If I was 18, I'd be voting for Jeremy Corbyn, probably.
And it's funny you say that, because I remember The Guardian published, I was in not this office, but an office like this on this campus during the 2017 election, and they reported that in Canterbury there were huge queues to vote Labour, and indeed we ended up with a Labour MP, the first time in its history. Not even in the days of Tony Blair did Canterbury go red, and I didn't even realise that there was a polling station on campus, because that obviously that's not my, I live outside of campus, and I thought I'll go for a walk to find out. So I thought ostensibly to go and get some crisps or something, or or coffee from the campus shop, and I thought, well, let's see if this story in The Guardian is right. And there was this biggest queue, and there were students, and I thought, previous elections, I say to my students sometimes, I remember the 2010 election, and I was using an analogy in one of my lectures, maybe I was talking about leadership and theology, and I, it was relevant to mention the upcoming election, and I just sort of got the vibe that there wasn't a huge amount of interest. I may have mentioned some of the stuff going on in the campaign. It didn't really resonate with anyone, but 2017 it did, and I again thought it just goes to show that when there's the right sort of alignment.
Well, I mean, he promised to waive the tuition fees, didn't he? So I mean, you'd be daft not to vote for it, wouldn't you, if you were a student at that particular point in time?
So it's, but again, quite different in that sense from previous elections, when the election
kind of shows people just vote in their own interest, generally speaking.
Oh, the cynic that he is. Well, as we start to wrap up, man, because we've spent a lot of time talking about Lampeter and deservedly so, but would you say, as you look back on your life and career, would you say that you're a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Well, I'd like to be a looking forward person. I do look forward, but I am also a chronic nostalgic, probably a bit like you. And I probably do spend too much time looking back on the past.
Do you do it through like diaries or photographs?
No, just through my head normally. And probably not quite as good as you, that recall date of the 92 election. But I've got a pretty good memory for years at least, maybe months, if not dates. And I can, people are always surprised that I can pinpoint a year that something happened, even if it's 30 years ago. But I think
Well,
I have to bow to you on that
I can't think of a better way to end on that bombshell. Matt, wonderful to catch up with you. Thank you very much.
Chris,
my guest
it's
this
been
week.
A real pleasure. Thank you. Cheers.